So welcome everyone to this week's Quantum Gravity Seminar. We have the pleasure today to have Thomas Thiemann from the University of Nuremberg. And his title is Quantum Bergmann Comma Group, the U1 cubed quantum gravity model and loop quantum gravity. So with this, Thomas, please start whenever you're ready.
Yeah, thanks for the introduction and for the invitation and the organization of the seminar. The course is designed as instructed for 40 to 45 minutes. Please feel free to ask questions in between. And this is my table of contents. So the talk consists of three parts: an introductory part in which I will explain what the Bergmann-Comma group is and what it has to do with space-time covariance, diffeomorphism covariance, and the so-called hypersurface deformation algebra. And then I will discuss a model in which one can study these highly non-trivial questions from a conceptual and technical perspective. And then I will mention some lessons and conclusions that one may draw from this investigation. So let me come to the first part of the talk. We are working here in a so-called canonical approach to classical and quantum general relativity, which has a long tradition in both the classical and the quantum aspects. In the classical regime, the canonical approach or Hamiltonian approach, also called the initial value formulation, is used, for example, in the numerical integration of Einstein equations when you are interested, for example, in the now famous black hole merger simulations, which are very necessary to understand gravitational wave physics. And the initiators of this formulation were Arnowitz, Deser, Meissner, and others. In the quantum regime, one considers quantum gravity as a quantum field theory, however, not an ordinary one on Minkowski space, but rather a quantum field theory which is generally covariant and is therefore required to work in the context of so-called constrained quantum field theory, where instead of having a Hamiltonian, which drives time translations, you have a Hamiltonian constraint, which is associated to diffeomorphisms, which or general coordinate transformations, which parameterize your invariance under time translations. So it's a very different kind of quantum field theory. Nevertheless, one can use Hamiltonian and canonical methods. The key assumption, which is basic for the whole setup, is that we are working in the context of globally hyperbolic spacetimes, which ensures that we have an well-defined classical initial value formulation. So given initial data, you can predict for sure what happens later on in your spacetime. And this has the striking consequence that the spacetime manifold is always of the type of a product of namely of a real line with three-dimensional spatial manifold, where of course the real manifold is the coordinatizing the time axis. In other words, even in the generically covariant context, you can always foliate space-time manifold by leaves, so-called hypersurfaces, on which you set up your Cauchy data for your initial value formulation. This is sometimes called the 3+1 split. And then one proceeds basically as you would do in your in your mechanics class, maybe you perform a Legendre transformation and you go from a metric and it's time derivative to canonically conjugate coordinates, which is a three-dimensional metric Q and its conjugate momentum. And you have Poisson brackets with which you can compute the equations of motions. The equations of motions are, of course, here in the gravitational context, the Einstein equations. So everything can be formulated just in this canonical framework. In particular, now we have, as I already mentioned, in this generally covariant context, you have now the phenomenon that you are confronted with constraints. So conditions on your initial data, if you want, or conditions on your configuration and momentum coordinate, which are called spatial diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian constraints. And I don't want to be to become too technical, so just believe me that these constraints, which are three spatial diffeomorphism constraints and one Hamiltonian constraint, they are just certain components of your Einstein equations, namely the temporal, spatial, and the temporal components of the Einstein equations with respect to the chosen foliation of spacetime. And this brings me then already in the position to discuss the hypersurface deformation algebra. So let me denote by capital Q the square root of the determinant of the three metric on these hypersurfaces. And let me consider the constraints smeared against test functions. These test functions U and F are sometimes called shift and lapse vectors, respectively. And then you can compute the Poisson brackets between these constraints, and these take this special form here. So the spatial diffeomorphisms constraints, they have closing Poisson brackets among themselves. U, V denotes the commutator of two vector fields. The spatial diffeomorphism acts on a Hamiltonian constraint by mapping the smearing field F to another one, which is obtained by acting with the vector field U on this smearing function F. And finally, the most interesting combination is the combination between two Hamiltonian constraints. And this gives you a diffeomorphism constraint, but there's a quite important difference between these two brackets and this bracket. Namely, this bracket, there's one ingredient which you can compute without using canonical data, which is this combination M, dn minus d, and dm. Dm is just the exterior derivative of a scalar field. So this whole thing in the round bracket is a one form. But then you contract it with the inverse of the three metric on your spatial hypersurfaces. So in other words, while these two first brackets here, they are very much like the brackets that you expect in an infinite dimensional Lie algebra, this third bracket is of a new type. And that these brackets take this form is a necessary consequence of spacetime covariance, as has been first observed in a very crucial paper by Hoymann, Kukash, and Teitel 1. So in other words, this is true for Einstein gravity, but it's also true for any other spacetime covariant theory that you may think of, for example, higher derivative theories or general relativity coupled to general matter fields. So observation is the following. This important set of equations encodes local spacetime covariance, spacetime diffeomorphism covariance in the canonical framework. Very crucially, it's observed that because of this due to a minus one factor, it is very necessary to have spatial metrics which are non-degenerate. The whole set of equations is not the form of a Lie algebra. Sometimes people call it a generalized Lie algebra or an open algebra or an algebroid. It just means that the right-hand side here is not the form of a structure constant, as you would expect from two Lie algebra, but actually it has structure functions because of this innocent-looking appearance of the Q to the minus one factor.
Thomas, we call it a business class constraint.
Say it again?
We call it a business class constraint.
A business class constraint, okay. Fine with me. Therefore, it becomes a little bit tricky to do natural things that what naturally do with a Lie group, like exponentiation. It's not straightforward to do that. It's not even clear how to what it means to do that. A mathematically careful approach would be the following. You calculate all possible brackets that you get from starting with these. So you generate a Lie algebra by computing all possible brackets among these and add all right-hand sides that you obtain to your set of Lie algebra elements. And then, of course, you get a Lie algebra, and then you can exponentiate. So this is what I would mean by the Bergmann-Koma group in what follows. And I will drop the prime again in for easier notation in what follows, but this is what one would call, as a mathematician, the Bergmann-Koma group generated by these basic relations. And an anomaly-free implementation of this Lie algebra then, or this Lie group, is a major challenge in any approach to quantum gravity. In two dimensions, in two space-time dimensions, you can get around this problem because there you can work with smearing functions which have density weight 2. I will not explain in detail what this means, but in this case, you can get rid of this. And then this is replaced by the so-called Witt algebra, whose quantization is known to be the Virasoro algebra. But this is only true in 1+1 dimensions. In higher dimensions, you cannot do that. So now all I have said is purely classical. Now we want to address the quantization of the theory, because after all, this is the quantum gravity seminar. We are not only interested in the vacuum case, but we want to add matter to the theory. So after all, we want to discuss the coupling between gravity and arbitrary matter that appears, for example, in the standard model. And one observes that in the Hamiltonian, the extended Hamiltonian added, which is obtained by adding the matter terms to your Hamiltonian constraint, you find out that for example, when you have spinorial matter, you cannot only deal with the metric, but you need to add more structure. And that additional structure involves now a triad, which is something like the square root of the three metric. And this triad couples to every possible term in your Hamiltonian constraint. And it is also possible and convenient to consider general relativity in this context with triads. So you have a conjugate momentum. You can choose it as a connection. And this brings the whole thing much closer to the gauge theory formulation that we are used to from, say, Young-Mills theory, Maxwell theory, or other gauge theories. And this, as I said, this triad. So the indices A, B, C, and so on, they label your space-time coordinates, and the indices J, K, and so on label the directions in the Lie algebra of SU2 in this case. So they run also from 1 to 3. In every single term in your Hamiltonian constraint couples to this triad. And just as we would do in ordinary quantum field theory on Minkowski space, where we formulate everything in terms of annihilation and creation operators, it is therefore very well motivated to pick a vacuum which is killed by this kind of Kiang-Mills electric kind of field. And this motivates to consider a vacuum such that this holds. Omega is my vacuum. The immediate observation is that this vacuum is therefore killed also by the determinant of the metric. So the vacuum itself is quantum degenerate. And this has some consequences. So here's the first of it. The corresponding representation of the commutation relations that are induced by the asking that these two fields E and A are canonically conjugate and that they are real valued. In other words, they are promoted to self-adjoint operators in the quantum theory. The corresponding representation of the canonical commutation and adjointness relations is fixed to be of a certain type, namely of the type of a Naunhofer-Turing type of representations. And it is usually convenient to avoid domain questions of operators by working with so-called while operators. So the while operators are the unitary operators that you obtain by exponentiating your conjugate variables, in this case, the electric field and the connection. And the consequence of choosing such a representation is that these operators violate one of the assumptions of the von Neumann-Stone theorem, namely they are not weakly continuous, but weakly discontinuous operators, which has the consequence that the corresponding Hilbert space is not separable. So we are not doing this because we are fond of having a non-separable Hilbert space, but we are somehow dynamically driven to this choice because we want to have a densely defined Hamiltonian constraint which kills the vacuum. So this is choices well motivated by dynamical investigations. Since the operators D, so the spatial diffeomorphism constraint and the Hamiltonian constraint, they depend on the connection itself and not of its exponential. One expects that one is better off to implement the Bergmann-Komar group, but rather than the Bergmann, than the hypersurface deformation algebra, because in this space hypersurface deformation algebra, this field A is not exponentiated, while in the exponentiation of the Lie algebra, it is appearing in exponentiated form, so that one can expect to be able to formulate things better in terms of these while operators. And in order to accomplish the requirement of quantum non-degeneracy, we are better off to choose smearing functions which are having support everywhere in space in order that the Bergmann-Komar group is well defined. So we have here a competition, as you can see, between on the one hand, the domain of the Hamiltonian constraint, which in particular motivates to choose a representation which is quantum degenerate. And on the other hand, in the sense that at least the vacuum is killed by the three metric. On the other hand, we have domain requirements by asking that the Bergmann-Krumbach group in the quantum theory becomes meaningful or well-defined. And this competition between these two domain questions will become a threat through my talk. So the further plan of my talk is then as follows. In the next part, I will consider a certain truncation of vacuum general relativity, which is the one cube model discovered by Lee Smolin more than 20 years ago. And I will show that it is a close relative of general relativity, technically much simpler, but still has the full complexity of the hypersurface deformation algebra in 3+1 dimensions. This model has two physical polarization degrees of freedom, so we do not lose, it's not a topological model or something like that. It's an interacting model, so it's not just linearized gravity or something like that. So it's really an interesting model to consider, which one can see is nothing but a weak Newtonian coupling constant limit of full general relativity. And for this model, at least, one can show that in this kind of strange representation that I was motivating and which we were driven to by dynamical considerations, in this kind of setting, one can complete the quantization program in such a way that the Bergmann-Krumbach group is represented in a non-anomalous way. In the last part of my talk, then I will discuss what one can learn from this model and which additional steps are necessary to go from this truncated model to the real untruncated model. So I start with the second part of my talk. So here is a one-line definition of this truncated model for vacuum general relativity. So one can also discuss the Lorentzian case, but for the purpose of my talk, it's much simpler to consider only the Euclidean case. So take Euclidean signature vacuum general relativity in these Ashtekar-Barbero gauge field variables and drop from the curvature that appears in the Hamiltonian constraint the A squared term. So the curvature for non-abelian Young-Mills theory always has a linear term, the term linear in A and the term quadratic in A. And the model is obtained by simply dropping the A squared term. So that is a Hamiltonian definition, or you can do the same thing at the level of the Lagrangian when you work in self-dual variables for Euclidean signature general relativity, and you all again drop the A squared term from the curvature. So this is almost Euclidean vacuum generality, but now the structure group becomes abelian. And with some additional steps, you reduce it from the Lorentz group, the structure group from the Lorentz group to the U1 cubed structure group. One can also see this model from a different perspective, which has been pointed out by Fernando Barbero just recently, namely it's a so-called consistent deformation can be obtained by a consistent deformation of Lagrangians in the sense that during the deformation of the Lagrangian, you do not lose the two physical degrees of freedom. So usually this is not so easy to do, but in this case it works. It has been also pointed out that there's a possible connection to twister string theory in a paper that came out about 15 years ago. I will not talk about much about this anymore. And the constraints that we have now in our theory are the following three constraints. So we not only have the spatial diffeomorphism constraint and the Hamiltonian constraint, but we also have, because we have additional gauge degrees of freedom coming from this U1 cubed gauge group, we also have an abelian Gauss constraint, which I denote by Z here. And RAB is nothing but the curvature of this connection A, where, as I promised, I just dropped the A squared term. If I would add this A squared term, this would be full general relativity in the vacuum. And astonishingly, this system of constraints has a completely unchanged hypersurface deformation algebra. It is astonishing from the point of view that you start with the Hamiltonian formulation and just drop some terms. But after seeing that it also can be derived from a generally covariant Lagrangian, it's no longer so such a surprise. In particular, the model still has this non-trivial, non-polynomial structure function. So all the complications that are coming from the hypersurface deformation algebra or the Bergmann-Hummer group are still there. Therefore, it is a slightly simpler theory than a full general relativity. So I'm dropping one of the terms, but still it's an interacting theory, because here you have a three. You have a polynomial of degree three, so it's not just a linear and quadratic term, but you also have self-couplings. So it's still a non-trivial theory with local degrees of freedom, but it's still technically simpler and therefore an ideal test laboratory for many technical and conceptual issues in quantum gravity. And it has been widely used in a set of very interesting works by Varadarajan, who has also drawn important conclusions from this model. So let us go quickly through the quantization program. So as I promised, I will be working with these kind of while operators, so exponentiated connections smeared against some test function F. Here, I'm using a three-dimensional smearing because, as I pointed out, in order to have a well-defined hypersurface deformation algebra or Bergmann-Hummer group, I want to have smearing functions which are supported everywhere in order that my volume or the determinant of my metric is everywhere non-degenerate. The while operators have rather particular vacuum expectation values between the vacuum. Namely, this is really the Kronecker delta supported at the smearing function being the zero smearing functions. And as we promised, the electric field or the momentum conjugate to the connection A kills the vacuum. So for those of you who have worked in the context of loop quantum gravity, this is a very similar kind of algebra of observables that I'm choosing here, except that I'm using a three-dimensional smearing functions, while in loop quantum gravity, we use one-dimensional smearing functions. And the reason for that will be discussed in the last part of my talk. But for the time being, you can consider these while elements here as generalized holonomies, if you are still familiar with loop quantum gravity, or F could be called a form factor in the context of Maxwell theory, while E of G, which are also smeared electric fields, are kind of fluxes, flux variables, familiar from abelian or non-abelian Young-Mills theory. in this kind of representation, the volume operator acts diagonally. So in particular, when you apply it to a while element, which is itself applied to the vacuum, you get an eigenvalue, which is proportional to the Planck volume times the determinant of the smearing function. And in order that the vacuum, that this state omega to which we apply this, the white element is non-degenerate, but we obviously need to have F to be non-degenerate. So for the Bergmann-Kummer group, we have now achieved that we have a dense domain of smearing functions, which are non-degenerate. So this is the first requirement that we wanted to have. And one can already see that one can solve the Gauss constraint quite simply by considering smearing fields which have vanishing divergence. The spatial diffeomorphism constraint and the Hamiltonian constraint cannot be defined per se because they involve the connection A and not its exponential. This is an effect that people from loop quantum gravity are very familiar with. And there one does things like polymerization. So one tries to approximate the linear operator A by these kind of holonomies with small smearing functions so that one can approximate the exponential by one plus the linear term. But if you don't want to do this and want to do an exact quantization, one can consider the question whether we can actually exponentiate these constraints and work with the Bergmann-Kummer group rather than hypersurface deformation algebra. And this is the most important observation. This actually works in this model. So we can really consider the exponentiated constraints. I really simply take D of U and C of F, exponentiate them, and apply them to while elements. And one can derive that this operator acts has a well-defined action on these while elements, and it acts in the following way. What you do is you take your classical combination of constraints, D of U plus C of M, you compute the classical Hamiltonian vector field, and you let this Hamiltonian vector field act on the smearing function as if it was the electric field as a considered as a canonical variable. So this is what this cumbersome formula wants to tell you. You just have to work with Hamiltonian vector fields of the constraints acting on the smearing function. So this is, to the best of my knowledge, the first quantum realization of the Bergmann-Kummer group in 3+1 dimensions. It is derived, not guessed, by using standard point splitting regularization of quantum operators. The operator U of U that I've defined here for arbitrary combination of constraints is in fact a unitary operator. And it reduces to the unitary operator corresponding to the spatial diffeomorphism group when I set F equal to zero. And it acts in exactly the same way that people from loop quantum gravity are familiar with. Now about anomaly freeness. So what I do, I take, as is usual, in, when you try to compute the action of a quantum representation of a group, and you want to consider whether it has anything to do with the classical group, you take this particular commutator of group elements. So S and T are some parameters, and F and G are some smearing functions corresponding to different Laplace functions, if you want. You apply it to a while element, and you compare this action, which can be computed, with the action of the operator, which corresponds to the right-hand side of the Poisson brackets between two Hamiltonian constraints with the same smearing functions. Let me call the outcome of this calculation on the left-hand side by the while element corresponding to f s, t, and on the right-hand side, f hat s, t. Then we say that the algebra is represented in an anomaly free way if the difference between these two results of the computation vanishes as we take s and t to zero. In fact, one has to take the derivative, second derivative of s and t at zero. And this can be verified to be the case in this case. It is important that we work with smearing functions which are everywhere non-degenerate. Moreover, the determinant of the smearing functions has to be everywhere well-defined, otherwise, or non-vanishing. Otherwise, the Hamiltonian vector fields would be ill-defined, and therefore, all of this would not work. So what are the further properties of this model? This is a technical remark. It refers to a recent perspective that has been spelled out by Madhavan Varadayan and Abhay Ashtekar, which stresses a certain similarity between the action of the Hamiltonian constraint and the diffeomorphism constraint in general, full general relativity. And there are some previous investigations along these lines by Giesel and myself. The action of the Hamiltonian flow on the smearing functions can be computed order by order in the order of this exponential that you can expand. But it's very highly nonlinear. It's very interesting how this flow acts on the smearing function in a fashion that one would never have guessed if one would have tried to do the things in a more brutal way. For example, I'm considering the action of the flow for the case that I'm switching off the vector field. So I'm considering really just the pure action of the Hamiltonian constraint on the smearing function. In order to formulate this action, I have to introduce a certain notation. So for two smearing functions, f and g, and Laplace function little f, I consider this particular combination here, which consists of an epsilon, which is the antisymmetric symbol acting on the Lie algebra indices, a commutator in the spatial indices, and followed by a partial derivative. This field, this action of the Laplace function on these two smearing functions can be seen to be, again, a divergence-free smearing function. And now we can discuss how different powers of this Hamiltonian flow act on the smearing function. So the first one gives you modulo inverse factors of determinant of f, gives you a bilinear expression corresponding to setting f and g equal to each other. This second order is a third order polynomial in f, again, modulo factors of an inverse of determinant of f. The third order is an even more complicated and more nonlinear expression, and so on and so forth. So it's the Hamiltonian flow of the Hamiltonian constraint on this smearing function is really very interesting. And I think I have never seen such a thing before. Now I want to get in contact with, loop quantum gravity, where one uses also smearing functions, but in the U1 cube model, one usually chooses them to be excited on a graph. And this will not work here because a graph is one-dimensional, so it can never be non-degenerate everywhere. But what I can do is I can mollify this smearing function, which in the case of U1 cube model is called a charge network function, with integers n, j, and e, where e labels a one-dimensional path or edge of a graph. And we integrate the delta function along such edge. And what I mean by mollifying is I'm thickening out this delta function so that the whole thing becomes everywhere non-degenerate again. Now, if I consider this model for such a smearing functions obtained by mollifying this delta functions, then in a certain sense, I still have labeling by my quantum states by graphs, but they are now thickened out in some in a technically precise sense. And the action of the Hamiltonian constraint is in that sense, again, along the whole graph and not only at vertices that one may be familiar with in loop quantum gravity. And there is no loop, abrupt loop attachment. Rather, the action is along the whole graph and not only at its vertices, and not located just in the vicinity of a vertex. And as I already pointed out, the action on the charges is quite non-polynomial.
Thomas?
Yes, please.
There were such thickenings contemplated when we were working with Chern-Simon theory. Chern-Simon says, is this similar to what was done there?
I think so. And also, you may recall that there was this interesting piece of work again by Madhavan, where he talked about the R-Fock representations for linearized gravity and Maxwell theory. So there he was also thickening out the loops. Yeah, so I think it's quite the same thing. As I said, one can make the model more interesting by adding potential terms. One potential term could be the cosmological constant or the term that would correspond to the Lorentzian piece of the Hamiltonian constraint. One can go further and try to solve the constraints. And one can do this in this model and compare it with the so-called reduced phase space quantization method, where you solve the constraints classically and then just quantize the physical degrees of freedom. And in this case, you can get a match of these two things. And the end result of this investigation, when you solve the constraints and pass to the physical observers, is that you get a self-interacting kind of electrodynamics. So you have two polarizations, like in Maxwell theory, linear Maxwell theory, without interactions. But here now you have an self-interacting Hamiltonian, which has this form. It has a magnetic field. And it has a polynomial piece, which is of second order in the electric field. So all together, this is already a third order polynomial. But then it's also divided by a polynomial again in the electric field. So it's nonlinear electrodynamics, if you want. And this is the physical Hamiltonian. There's more to say. So there's also access to so-called weak Dirac observers for the experts of CDJ type. I will not go into the details here. And one can also hope to formulate a spin form model for the U1 cubed model, which would be an abelian spin form model, which is would be very interesting to have and compare with this canonical formulation. And first steps I already took in my paper, but there's certainly much more to do. So let me come to the end of my talk and to the discussion session. The U1 cube model is almost quantum integrable in the Fraunhofer-Thirring type of representation. Almost, I say, because I haven't solved the spectral problem for the physical Hamiltonian that I displayed here in the bottom line. But in this model, one can see beautifully a convergence of ideas in general, canonical, coherent, and relational observables kind of ideas. For me, this is now from now on a stepping stone, or marking stone, or paradigm model, kind of a harmonic oscillator of quantum gravity in four dimensions. So if something works for this, not works for this model, it won't work in the full three. The model stresses the importance to have a non-degenerate formulation, and this, which is part of the definition of the hypersurface deformation algebra or Bergmann-Kumar group. And now, what can we learn from this model for the full theory? In the current setup of loop quantum gravity, all states in the Hilbert space are located on graphs or loops, as the name loop quantum gravity says. And this is not because people were not paying attention, but rather because the additional complications of adding the A squared term to your Hamiltonian force you to this kind of states. Otherwise, you would not get the Hamiltonian constraint densely defined in the Hilbert space. On the other hand, unfortunately, most or all of the states that one discusses in loop quantum, their general loop quantum gravity, are therefore supported on graphs, and therefore do not satisfy one of the or part of the definition of the hypersurface deformation algebra, namely that quantum states should be quantum non-degenerate. So why or what is the reason why we can solve this tension in the model? We can solve the tension in the model because in this model, the Hamiltonian vector field of the Hamiltonian constraint preserves, technically speaking, the momentum polarization of the phase space. In other words, a function of the electric field is mapped to a function of the electric field. And when you add the A squared term, this is no longer the case, and this makes the difference between the U1 cubed and the non-untruncated model. So, in other words, in full quantum gravity, the Hamiltonian constraint is not polarization preserving. And this is the technical reason why we are forced into this graph picture, where states are excited along one-dimensional graphs. So we solve one of the requirements, namely that the Hamiltonian constraint is densely defined, but we violate one of the or part of the definition of the hypersurface deformation algebra, namely that we should have states which are quantum non-degenerate. So how to solve this tension? Here's my proposal, and this is the last statement of my talk. We want to combine both requirements, namely a quantum degenerate representation, in order to have states in the domain of the hypersurface deformation algebra. And we also want to have, of course, states in the domain of the Hamiltonian constraint, which is part of this hypersurface deformation algebra, but not all of it. And the first approach is suggested in the paper by Fernando. So maybe one should take this integrable model seriously and perform a perturbation theory around this integrable model in order to obtain the full untruncated quantum gravity model. Maybe a more systematic approach would be to use randomization methods. So the idea would be to solve the theory first on at finite resolutions, let's say on graphs, and now the graphs define your universe. So there's nothing else than the graphs in themselves. Therefore, by definition, all the states on the graph are non-degenerate because there's nothing in between, because you're finite at finite resolution. Then you construct the infinite resolution theory using the renormalization flow, and thereby you transport the quantum non-degeneracy into a new representation, which is obtained by following the renormalization flow. So this is something that is work in progress, something that my collaborators and me are working on right now. But this is something that somehow suggested by the investigation of this U1 cube model. This ends my talk. I thank you for your attention.
Okay, thank you, Thomas. Thank you very much for this great talk. So yeah, I already see a question by Lee. Lee, do you want to go first?
Sure, Thomas, first of all, beautiful, beautiful work and talk. And it's wonderful to see. Let's go off in a new direction like this. I was just going to mention that my response for a long time to the situation has been to hope, to look for hope in the thickening of graphs coming from the quantum deformation and finite cosmological constant. And I think you probably know what I'm talking about. I wonder if you have a view of that kind of direction.
That would be very interesting. Yes, if you can point me to the right point in the literature, or if you have some ideas along these lines, I would be very interested. Yes.
Okay, I'll send you. Okay. There's a paper I wrote in 1995, which starts. It's not what you'd like to do, but it starts in that direction.
Okay, I'd be very curious to see this.
Okay, so actually, are there any questions by students?
Yes.
Okay, so this is not the case. So I see a raised hand by Roland. Do you want to ask a question?
Can you hear me?
Sure.
Thank you very much for the talk, Thomas. That was very interesting. So I think the theory that you call U1 cubed quantum gravity is probably what people in, well, Twister literature and maybe other literature called self-dual gravity, in the sense that its equations of motion are equivalent to, as a Lagrangian theory, its equations of motion, the self-duality of the Weyl tensor and the vacuum-Einstein equations. Does that sound right?
Yeah, so I'm not very familiar with this Twister string theory, but I have studied a little bit this paper by Abu Zaid. And indeed, the classical starting point or the possible connection to Twister string theory is going through this kind of weak Newtonian constant limit of full general relativity, which brings you in contact to the so-called Siegel formulation of general relativity and its linearization. From there you go, I think, in quite non-trivial steps towards the Twister string theory using the quantum double and the connection of super young mystery with Twister string theory.
If this is self-dual gravity, so this has been studied quite a bit, and also we've been studying it recently as well. And we would have usually thought that it is classically integrable, but it isn't quantum integrable because of the presence of the one loop or plus amplitudes. And from the Twister perspective, those represent an actual anomaly in the Twister description. And sort of the classical integrability of self-dual gravity would manifest in the existence of this infinite dimensional sort of hidden symmetry, which is actually a chiral algebra. And you can see that this chiral algebra in the quantum theory, it gets deformed and it fails to be associative. Now, this shouldn't be a problem with the class. It shouldn't be a problem with the theory on space-time. You should be able to, at least in perturbation theory, quantum self-dual gravity exists, but you would expect this infinite group of hidden symmetries to be anomalous. Essentially because of the presence of the one equal plus amplitude. So I was just curious if there was any way to see this from this perspective, or maybe these are just different theories, I don't know, but I suspect that they're secretly the same.
No. So first of all, I would be nice if you could point me to the literature that you have in mind so that I can give you a more detailed answer. But for now, I can tell you that I'm not surprised that this is the case, that you have anomalies in a different representation of your quantum theory, because really this existence or non-existence of anomalies is representation. And the representation that I'm choosing here is quite different from Fokker representations or representations that you obtain by using perturbation theory around Fock space. And therefore, one does not see the anomaly in this case.
Well, I see, but the anomaly is not really an anomaly with the four-dimensional theory. So it shouldn't necessarily represent an obstruction to quantizing it on four-dimensional space. It should really only manifest itself in this infinite dimensional hidden symmetry of it. I don't know if you see this infinite dimensional. I guess it should be like the loop algebra, the Lie algebra of Hamiltonian vector fields on C squared.
I'm talking about this infinite dimensional symmetry. This is this hypersurface deformation algebra or quantum Koma group.
So it's a chiral algebra. So it's a vertex algebra.
People call this thing by different names, but I guess yes, it's the same thing. Well, you should see also this effect of the inverse metric.
It could be. Anyway, it'd be very interesting to nail down.
Yeah.
I mean, does this have all the all plus amplitudes? So if I mean, maybe that's not a sensible question, but would you expect it to have the all plus amplitudes?
I haven't understood acoustically the last sentence. What, say it again, please?
So self-dual gravity, the only non-trivial amplitudes it has are the one loop all plus amplitudes, apart from the three-point vertex. So does this, I don't know, sorry, this Hamiltonian description is a kind of very different way of looking at it than I would, but I would usually do so from a twisted perspective. But is it meaningful to ask, does it have one loop all plus amplitudes?
So I think that in some sense your question is answered by this kind of formulas here. So this encodes your polynomial degree kind of interactions in this representation. So it's not quite nonlinear.
Okay. Oh, true. Okay. Well, it would be very interesting to kind of marry the two pictures of one another.
Probably we have to match our languages to see better what the connection is.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
More questions? Okay, so then I can maybe ask a question. So when you introduce the U1 model, you said that you dropped the A squared terms, and I think you already partially addressed this in your conclusion. But I was wondering, so how would the inclusion of the A squared term change the subsequent analysis? So what does that change in particular? And what would it take to include the A squared term?
So at the moment, I think the two most promising avenues would be this first and second approach that I mentioned here. One can either use ideas from perturbation theory and try to perturb the full untruncated theory around the integrable model. Or one can use normalization methods. So what one does is one uses or one takes it seriously the formulation of a loop quantum gravity where one works with graphs, but now you work in a universe which just consists of this graph, and therefore both the domain questions for the Hamiltonian constraint and for the hypersurface deformation algebra are satisfied. But of course, you're not interested in this finite resolution theories. You're interested in the the continuum limit, so to say. And therefore, you need to follow the randomization flow and consider the fixed point of this flow, which hopefully then gives you a theory in which both requirements, both domain requirements are satisfied.
Okay, thank you. So this
answer is of course extremely short. In order to explain it properly, it deserves a whole other talk. So I'm sorry, I cannot explain this in a better way.
Yeah, that already helps. Thank you. Any more questions?
Yes.
Okay, if that's not the case, let's thank Thomas again.